Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this week's conversation on race and policing. Our guest today is Ruby Nadiri from the Brennan Center for Justice. My name is Matt Patino. I'm an adjunct instructor of history at Crafton Hills College. I am also a former police officer. I'll turn it over now to my colleague, Robbie Madrigal.
Thank you, Matt. I'd like to add my welcome. My name is Robbie Madrigal from the Fowl Library, and I will do the land acknowledgement. We recognize that California State University San Bernardino sits on the territory and ancestral land of the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians. We recognize that every member of the California State University San Bernardino community has benefited and continues to benefit from the use and occupation of this land since the institution's founding in 1965. Consistent with our values of community and diversity, we have a responsibility to acknowledge and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. By offering this land acknowledgement, we affirm Indigenous sovereignty and will work to hold California State University San Bernardino more accountable to the needs of American Indian and Indigenous peoples. I'll turn it over to my colleague, Jeremy Murray.
Thanks, Robbie. I'm Jeremy Murray, and I teach history here at Cal State San Bernardino. And I'll turn the floor over to Amber Broughton.
Thank you, Jeremy. Peace, everyone. My name is Amber Broughton. I serve as an adjunct faculty in the psychology department at both CSU Dominguez Hills and San Bernardino with a specialization in legal and forensic science. I'll turn that over to Michael.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mike German, a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law School and a former FBI special agent. It's my pleasure to introduce you to my colleague, Ruby Nadiri, who's a senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program. She manages the Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration Project, a coalition of nearly 200 police chiefs, correctional officials, and federal and state prosecutors from around the country who are committed to laws and practices that more effectively fight crime while reducing unnecessary imprisonment. Before joining the Brennan Center, Ruby served as the Deputy Director of Fair and Just Prosecution, a national organization that brings together elected local prosecutors as part of a network committed to furthering a new vision for prosecution. Prior to that, she served for a decade and a half as a federal prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York. She has also held positions at the Office of Legal Counsel and National Security Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, and as Director of the Criminal Justice for the Laura and John Arnold Foundation. She also serves on the Board of Directors for the Women's Prison Association, the nation's first organization for women impacted by incarceration. Ruby holds a Juris Doctorate from Columbia University School of Law and a BA from Princeton University. Ruby, thank you for joining us today. For the audience members joining today, feel free to use the Q&A feature to submit any questions you might have that come up during the discussion. Ruby, please tell us about your work at the Brennan Center and the Law Enforcement Leaders Project.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And I want to thank everyone on the panel and also the audience. I'm very excited to have this conversation on this really important topic about race and justice in policing. I want to definitely give an overview of the group of law enforcement leaders that I manage at the Justice Program, and also talk a little bit about the work of the Justice Program itself, and then, you know, talk a little bit about some examples of the work that LEL has done, and then really open it up for conversation with the panel and the audience. As you mentioned, Mike, Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration is a coalition that was created by the Brennan Center's Justice Program that brings together about 200 current and former police chiefs, corrections leaders, sheriffs, chief prosecutors from around the country who are committed to reducing incarceration and creating safer and healthier communities. The project was started back in 2015. Which is something that's, I think, notable about the project itself and also where it stands today, and which I'd love to talk a little bit more about. So unlike the typical voice of law enforcement, which often seems to be reflexively supportive of punitive approaches, such as more criminalization and higher sentences, Law Enforcement Leaders, or LEL as we call it, is an important and unique voice to support justice reform. I joined the Brennan Center a year ago to reinvigorate the project, which had been less active in recent years. So let me talk a little bit about our overall goals of the project, which I think is very much tied to thinking about the movement for bringing reform. to our system, both nationally and locally. Part of what we try to do is to leverage the authoritative voice of law enforcement. As I mentioned, it is a reliable and credible, relied upon and credible voice in the public conversation about public safety. So this is the voice of law enforcement to advance justice reform that says actually reducing incarceration, reducing racial disparities, and really intentionally trying to build trust between law enforcement and communities is actually important for public safety. We also combine LEL members' expertise in law enforcement with the Brennan Center's Justice Program's data-driven expert research to make the case that justice reform policies are critical for public safety. We are trying to identify different ways to use our platform strategically to amplify this core idea. And we also, particularly in the current climate, which I'd love to talk a little bit more about, are using the LEL voice to push back against claims that reforms cause increased crime and against efforts to roll back reforms. And another goal that we've been sort of starting over this past year since I've started managing the project is fostering a learning community within the group where law enforcement members can share their innovations and learn from each other and external experts. So it is very much intentionally a broad coalition that has sought to be bipartisan, and it includes a spectrum of views on reform. Some members are more right of center, some are more left of center. And what that means is that the changes and reforms that we support may lean to being more incremental from, you know, kind of in the broad spectrum of what people want to see change in our justice system. But it also, I think, crucially, from my perspective, those changes have a more likely chance of being passed or implemented. So in some ways, it's a balance. That's a conversation that's ongoing in the reform community. As I mentioned, it's housed in the Justice Program at the Brennan Center. So let me tell you a little bit about the work of the Justice Program. Our goal is to build a more proportionate and just criminal justice system that incarcerates less and addresses racial and economic disparities, protecting public safety while reducing the scale of incarceration. The program is also the source of rigorous research that produces cutting-edge policy ideas. We focus on three primary areas, all of which are in many ways linked with LEL's broader mission as well. We focus on changing the public narrative around crime and public safety through original research, and also, I guess, on-the-spot fact checks. That's the way I would put it, that delinks increases in crime from justice reforms where the evidence and research indicates. One example is just about 10 days ago, colleagues of mine fact-checked the speech that former President Trump gave at CPAC, in which he really much leaned into the idea that, you know, blue cities where reform has happened are, you know, places where crime is just ravaging the streets, and also that migrants cause crime. A colleague recently participated in an important interview with the USA Today podcast about why so many people still don't believe that crime is receding, even though the evidence shows that it is actually going down in vast swaths of the country. And we engage in similar efforts throughout the year. We also work on addressing racial and economic disparities in the justice system. For example, we produced a report in July of 2022 that dives deeply in the perverse financial incentives that drive excessive punishment at all levels of the system that results in mass incarceration and a heavy financial burden on those least able to pay, particularly Black and Brown communities. Many local governments, for example, rely on fines and fees, sometimes building budgets around them. And the system has been really shown, for example, in the Ferguson report that the Department of Justice released after the Michael Brown killing, really incentivizes burdens on communities of color and also exacerbates economic disparities and exacerbates recidivism and, you know, kind of creates cycles of incarceration. Law enforcement leaders, LEL, has added its voice to eliminate fines and fees. For example, signing on to successful efforts to eliminate juvenile fines and fees in Oregon and California. The Justice Program also produces cutting-edge policy ideas to reduce unnecessary incarceration, such as a proposal to reduce unnecessary incarceration that explained how for decades the federal government has used its grant-making power to spur states to incarcerate more people and impose larger sentences, and laying out ways that the federal government can now reverse course and actually use its grant-making power to reduce incarceration. We also work on improving the conditions of people behind bars to create more humane conditions and produce better life outcomes and ultimately promote safer communities. And LEL works with current and former corrections leaders to voice support for prison oversight, improved alternatives to incarceration, and improved conditions of confinement. Now, LEL partners with the Justice Program, but we also have our own portfolio and mission identity that fits within that broader framework. We have our own executive board of current and former law enforcement leaders who help guide where we engage. And I'd like to spend a few minutes giving a few examples of some of the work that LEL has done, and then we can kind of open it up for questions and happy to talk more in detail about any of this. We actively support primarily federal. Our staff is limited. It's me and a policy associate. So we don't have wide ability to engage at the state level, although we are very interested in exploring some more of that. We engage on a variety of issues, including, as I mentioned, fines and fees reform, reducing mandatory minimum sentences and other sentencing reforms, and improving reentry services. We've done this by coordinating member signatures on sign-on letters, drafting and placing op-eds, engaging in, for example, congressional briefings and writing reports. One highlight that I want to just focus on in the past few years that was very important effort by LEL was we played a critical role in the successful passage of the First Step Act, which was the most significant federal criminal justice reform in a generation, signed into law in December of 2018. It may not have been as transformative change as many advocates may have been hoping for. In fact, it was called the first step for a reason. The idea was it would be built on, but it was significant and meaningful. In her book, Reform Nation, The First Step Act and the Movement to End Mass Incarceration, that came out last year, sociologist Colleen Aaron has called it one of the few major pieces of federal criminal justice reform since the 1970s. To gesture at reversing the incarceration frenzy. So we're really talking about, 50 years of building up our system of mass incarceration and the work that's needed to cut back on that. Among other things, the law lowered some mandatory minimum sentences, provided more circumstances under which judges can use their discretion to decide the sentence without being bound by the mandatory minimum, allowed individuals in certain categories, such as the elderly and ill, to petition directly to a court for compassionate release, thereby bypassing the Bureau of Prisons, the BOP. It provided an expansion of a BOP pilot program that it provided for early release to home confinement, expanded employment opportunities within prison facilities. And in order to help leave individuals who were leaving prison, the BOP was required to provide them with identification. The law's prison reforms focused on respecting the humanity of individuals who are incarcerated, such as prohibiting the shackling of individuals during pregnancy, and also requiring that individuals be housed, be placed within 500 miles of their families if possible, which doesn't seem like a huge win, but previously there was no geographical limit, and that means a lot to individuals who are incarcerated and their families. So since the First Step Act was passed, thousands more people leaving the federal prison system have rebuilt their lives without reoffending, which is really remarkable and really shows how small, and the goal of it is really to show how we can make these small incremental changes, show they work, and build on them. And that's the hope. It hasn't happened yet, but that is the hope that when you get reform passed, you can continue to build on it. And the importance of LEL supporting it cannot be really overstated. At the time, in a press statement, Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, a key sponsor, thanked LEL on the floor for its support and cited LEL's engagement as an essential law enforcement perspective in the initial stages of the bill's development. So we've done, that was probably one of the most important things that we did, and that was back in 2018. More recently, we've been focusing on increasing the profile of LEL and elevating its shared view that law enforcement can be a voice for change. And also at a time when the public safety conversation has become more polarized, than it was in 2015 when the group was started, or even 5 years ago in 2018 when the First Step Act passed. So reform efforts are, I think, in a somewhat more defensive posture today than they were back then. That's understandable as fear, you know, as crime, you know, was shown to have risen in 2020 and 2021 in the wake of the pandemic. Unfortunately, political posturing, blaming crime on reforms has really continued even as crimes begin to show signs of dropping. So the fear mongering and political polarization has made the reasonable, thoughtful voice of law enforcement leaders who are saying, yes, actually these reform measures keep us safe, even more important. So that's been an important part of the work that we've been doing in this last year, is finding ways to elevate the work that law enforcement can be doing and what law enforcement has done. I know that I have talked quite a bit, and I'm going to stop here and open it up for questions. I'm happy to talk more about the work that LEL has done so far and anything else that people want to talk about. So thank you again for this opportunity.
Great. Thank you. That it was really a lot of information that's very helpful. Since you were speaking about the First Step Act, what do you think the next steps are, and where is advocacy going, as you said, in this era where the conversation has changed a little bit and advocacy for reform is a bit on the defensive?
I think that's a great question. So I think one of the things that we have found, unfortunately, is that we've had to even, and advocates at the federal level has talked about how over the course of the past year, even having to defend the work of the First Step Act, like what the First Step Act actually did. And so there's been a lot of work done working with allies. We, for example, as part of that whole effort, organized a congressional briefing in December where we brought together law enforcement leaders and an advocate and an individual who had been a beneficiary of the First Step Act, a congressional briefing called The First Step Act at Five, a Bipartisan Victory for Public Safety and Communities. And really it was part of this whole effort to try and continue to beat the drum that this act was actually really important for public safety. And I think part of what we talked about in that, and also, you know, I co-authored an op-ed with my colleague, the executive director of Law Enforcement Leaders, who's a former police chief, about the work and the importance of the First Step Act and the success that it has and the importance of building on it. And I think, you know, there's some pending federal legislation that really could be really important to build on that, including a prison oversight bill that's basically allowing for the first time external oversight of BOP facilities, which seems again like fairly basic, but it doesn't exist and it's really important. Another high priority for many of us in the justice reform space at the federal level is the EQUAL Act. EQUAL stands for Eliminating a Quantifiably Unjust Application of the Law Act of 2021. It's a mouthful, but EQUAL is definitely what it's trying to do. As many people are probably aware, in 1986, the Anti-Drug Abuse Act established mandatory minimum sentences for specific amounts of cocaine and its alternatives. And unfortunately, this legislation concluded mistakenly that crack cocaine was scientifically more addictive and that crack cocaine incited violent behavior. So Congress punished crack cocaine offenders 100 times more harshly than powder cocaine offenders. In other words, a person convicted of distributing 5 grams of crack would receive a mandatory minimum of 5 years imprisonment, while a person convicted of distributing 500 grams of powder cocaine, 100 times more cocaine, would receive the exact same sentence. So in the 30 years since Congress did that, we now know that there is scant, non-existent scientific evidence supporting that disparity. In 2010, the Fair Sentencing Act reduced that sentencing disparity from 100-1 to 18-1. So the EQUAL Act, which has been pending for the past few years, law enforcement leaders has been a strong advocate along with many other groups working on these issues across the political spectrum. So the Congress must once and for all say that eliminate the sentencing disparity altogether and attempt to unwind the damage wrought by that. And it's important, really, like significant from both a equity perspective, fairness, logical sentencing, all of those things, but also really important to recognize that crack cocaine sentencing laws have had particularly severe consequences for Black Americans. While comprising less than a third of people convicted of powder cocaine trafficking, Black Americans make up nearly 81% of those convicted of crack cocaine related crimes in 2019. So that disparity will have a huge impact on eliminating that some of those inequities, not all of them, of course, but really it seems like a thin slice, but something like that could be really significant. And there's a number of other federal efforts, I think, and also at the state level, including things like Equal at the state level, that could be really important. Other things that maybe are a little bit more further on the horizon, but maybe still things that we should be thinking about are sentencing reform from, measures to reduce sentences that were already imposed. So for example, sentences that were imposed at a time, you know, a 20-year sentence that maybe today we would look at it, and say that's not a sentence that should be imposed today, but ways to go back and reopen those sentencing avenues, either at the federal level or at the state level. Again, it's something that, you know, even prosecutors and police leaders have come out in support of, because many people recognize that these lengthy sentences that people have been serving are not serving public safety, are not. There's a lot of conservatives who have come out in favor of some of those efforts because an understanding that, you know, between whether it's values that you, whether it's fiscal or redemption or other ideas about the idea that we can penalize people for life is something that people are, that there are, there is a movement that's thinking very thoughtfully about how we can unwind some of the mistakes that we've made in the past.
And you mentioned Senator Grassley, Republican from Iowa, specifically calling out the advocacy of law enforcement leaders. Can you talk about what it's like doing advocacy where, you know, you're recruiting odd bedfellows, people that liberals might not necessarily look at as champion for criminal justice reform? And how law enforcement leaders plays a role in that.
I mean, I think that, you know, within the criminal justice reform movement, there has been a recognition that people can come to it from different perspectives and maybe even with different agendas. But, you know, it may be, for example, that you're coming at it because you want to address racial disparities in the system. Because you want to reduce the punitive enforcement mechanism because it comes down harshly on particular communities, because those are the values that are driving you. Other people may come at it because they think of the fiscal waste, the fiscal cost of lengthy sentences, of our prisons, of our policing. They think of the fact that, you know, maybe from a religious perspective, the idea that you never give somebody the chance to have a second chance, that that is a problem. And somehow or other, you know, it's not easy, but it is possible. And I think things like the First Step Act show how you can actually bring these different, different motivators and different, you know, value systems together for something that, you know, I think in the end, it may not be what everybody wanted. Like, and nobody comes to the table and leaves the table having getting exactly what they wanted from that conversation. But what they do get is some progress, and the idea is then that we build on progress. And I think that it's going to be interesting to see longer term, maybe not in the short term, but longer term, how these different constituencies can continue to work together when, you know, we are in a much more polarized, I think, society than we were maybe 10 years ago, particularly on these particular issues. But I think that there is a desire among many different communities to still try and see progress, even if people have different ideas of what the longer term goal might be.
And how difficult is it to recruit within law enforcement to participate in the reform agenda, particularly as you mentioned that you know, society in general seems more polarized, but particularly as we saw after the protest following the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis Police Department, a hostile response to demands for reform.
You know, it's interesting. I think that there's a lot of, you know, the people that I've talked to about this in policing and prosecution, there are a lot of people who recognize that policing and prosecution are doing things that really, you know, they don't want to be doing. And I think that that's an important, we ask our criminal legal system, justice system actors, the police, prosecutors, et cetera, to answer to or to be the responders for a lot of societal ills that they do not want to actually be doing. And they understand that they are not the best responders for that. So for example, you will have, you know, sheriffs and police chiefs who are saying, you know, the patrols, like they don't want to actually be the only responder available for a mental health call or, you know, for the unhoused person who's on the street. We understand that we are not actually solving the problem by putting these people in jail or by arresting them, that we need to figure out other resources and other avenues. So I think that there is, even in a polarized environment, people who are actually on the ground doing the work, a lot of them really recognize that this is not really the work that we signed up to do or that we want to be doing, and we're not the right responders for this. On the flip side, we are actually the only responders sometimes in many communities. So we are actually, we're called on, and then also when, you know, the problem persists, we are blamed because there's nothing else out there. And so people are like, I call the police, and the police don't actually think that they should be the only responder. And so I think that there's a real interest in trying to figure out alternatives, alternative responders, things like how do you develop programs where, you know, for a mental health call, it is not only the police or it is co-response groups or something like that. Thinking about alternatives to arrest for people with substance issues, whether it's diversion or, you know, deflection, deflecting them to actual treatment. But the problem is, of course, or the challenge is, you have to also have treatment funded, or you have to have treatment services, or, you know, those other things also need to be funded and available. And I think that's the challenge, really, that people sometimes find with the critique of policing or prosecution, that we're asked to do a lot. And then the challenge of figuring out, how do you step back if there is nothing else there? Because if something happens, then maybe we'll be the ones who are blamed, or we're the ones that the burden is going to fall on. So I think it's an ongoing conversation that communities are having about how best to respond to some of these harms.
Great. Amber, I see you have a question.
I'd like to go, but I saw Matt's hand first.
It's okay.
So my question, Ruby, I was a cop in the late 80s. Right after mandatory minimums became part of our job. And we would, from time to time, have to arrest somebody who was under the influence of a controlled substance, and automatically they received a 90-day sentence, which brings me to kind of the point, your last point, but also earlier when you were talking about the parameters for determining success in reform. Are you only looking at recidivism and the FBI crime statistics, but are you also looking at the number of diversions that are now available and alternatives?
I think that it's, I would think about it more broadly than just crime statistics. Although I think our, you know, we are always engaging in a conversation with the public about reform, right? I mean, I think the public conversation about reform turns a lot on crime statistics. So that is the world that we operate in when we're talking about reform. So we need to be realistic about how we, I think, communicate about the impact of reform, because I think I do believe that when people believe that they are unsafe, whether it is, you know, the crime rates show that crime is growing up or reporting is about crime, whatever it is, the feeling and perception of safety is going to be a really central element about how we understand whether reform is successful or not, or our policies are successful or not. So we have to engage in the conversation about crime and crime rates. I think it's also important, though, to talk about, and this is where I think the recidivism part comes in, to talk about how the current system fails people in a way that I think the public sometimes doesn't always focus on. And the Justice Program at the Brennan Center has done a lot of work talking about the costs of incarceration, not even societal costs, of course, but also the costs on the individual, like lost wages and loss. And that sounds very, you know, maybe hard-headed and economic and fiscal, but I think that speaks to what people understand about what happens when somebody actually goes to prison. And I think people think also, I mean, this also goes to conditions of confinement, right? Like it's the conversation we have about what is helping people and what is not. I mean, to the extent that people understand prison as a place that is rehabilitative, the extent to which we as people who are knowledgeable about the system and work within the system can show, actually, you know what? Prison actually does not serve that purpose. And so I think that we measure success by both talking about and addressing the perceptions that people have about what's going on in the street, and also trying to educate the public about the costs of the system, which includes the importance of diversion. Because I think if you can show, for example, that that diversion programs are reducing recidivism, and improving people's ability to return to society more quicker and engage with their families and be back with their families and work and all of the other things that people want people to be able to do, then you can show that diversion programs are successful. I think sometimes the public conversation about diversion becomes, oh, that person just got off. Like they were, you know, it's not a conversation about also the burdens of these programs, which are not, they're not easy programs for people to participate in. But I think there's a lot of, and that's why, you know, both in Law Enforcement Leaders and the Justice Program, we try to do a lot of educating about the public about a lot of these things, because I think that there are misconceptions, and some of it is media driven, some of it is just easier, some of it is politics driven, but some of it is also just, you know, people are busy and they don't have the time to engage in these issues like, you know, experts or people who are living day to day in it do. So I encourage a lot of particularly people who have the time, like in academia, to, you know, kind of really dig into things like the costs of the system and educating people about those things.
Thank you. And Amber.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ruby. Your conversation is very enlightening. Some of the aspects, I won't say a lot of them, are things that I bring up within my legal and forensic psychology class. So I do have a question, but I also have a lengthy kind of response to share with you. One aspect that I really appreciate about what you've highlighted is this underbelly of the policing conversation for women being shackled during pregnancy. So my master's thesis was actually about the experience that pregnant incarcerated women have, right? I've done some work within the DC jail where I really sat and spoke with inmates about what their day-to-day life looked like, right? And what kind of resources were available to women, right? Especially in this process of, let's say, going through our cycle month to month or experiencing pregnancy. So I wanted to ask you, in lieu of that, have you noticed that there's been any funding or policy changes that are centered around this demographic of individuals who are incarcerated? I wrote my master's thesis, a writ of certiorari, on Diana Sanchez, who had experienced giving birth while incarcerated, but received no medical attention, no medication, et cetera. And so it was a very grueling experience to watch, right? The CCTV video. You also talk about what I've come to learn is the 100-to-1 crack ratio, right? And there's an author, also a lawyer by the name of Brittany Barnett, who wrote a book called A Knock at Midnight. And she's interested in releasing individuals who have also been wrongfully convicted, but she talked about this sentencing error, right? Where you have policing that looks a little bit more dramatic in one context, or if you have, again, that 100-to-1 ratio, you're getting the same sentencing, for example. And so with that, in my classes, I've also shown my students the U.S. Sentencing Commission. I'll drop some links in the chat for what I'm specifically talking about. But in 2023, they released a criminal history amendment where they looked at the sentencing guidelines and changing the conversation, right, for individuals that have been incarcerated. So I just really appreciate you highlighting so many different aspects, right? Because even in modern day, we're still seeing the issue kind of roll over, right? Generation into generation. And so with all that being said, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned we saw a crime rate increase at the start of the pandemic. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think that is? Where do you think that comes from, right? We have the racial and economic disparities, but what else could it be?
I think, you know, when you talk about what drives crime, I think it's a really complicated question. And I hate to like cop out on that, but I do think it's important to recognize that I think a lot of times we don't actually really know what causes crime to rise and what has caused it to go down. We can speculate, we can, you know, kind of surmise that, okay, like looking back, crime went up in 2020 and 2021 across the country. It was not limited to cities, liberal places, conservative places. It was urban areas. It was rural areas. It was across the country. And was there, you know, I'm not a sociologist or an economist or, you know, statistician. I'm a lawyer for a reason. So I don't like to dig into numbers, but I can say that, you know, my colleagues who are experts on this will talk about how the fact that it went up across the country in 2020 and 2021, and now we are seeing, and hopefully it will continue, that it is going down in a lot of places, including New York City. There are pockets around the country where it's still persistently still up. And we still don't know. We still don't know what's causing that. And I think one of the things to keep in mind, and the reason that I think that's important, is that that humility of not, we don't really actually know. We don't know really why crime went up. I mean, there are people who have theories, right, about why crime went down in the post-90s and 2000s. I think Patrick Sharkey has a book, you know, his whole, it was all like, the idea was that there was this rise in community groups that tracks the idea where places where crime went down. There's the whole theory around space and greenery and lighting as places that, you know, creates public safety. One thing I think that we can, that I'm pretty confident saying is that while we don't know what causes crime to go down or up, or I'm not comfortable saying that, I'm confident in saying that the costs of the mass incarceration that we have seen, whether it's costs, fiscal costs, economic costs, social costs, all of that indicates that we should be thinking about how do we create public safety without reflexively turning to punitive enforcement as the be-all and end-all answer to reducing crime. And I think that that is what law enforcement leaders and the justice program and a lot of different groups across the political spectrum are looking at, because I think we, you know, part of the challenge of the conversation is that everybody wants safety. A lot of communities get safety. A lot of communities don't get safety, regardless of whether we're talking about high crime, low crime, you know, whatever's going on in the political agenda. And so I think that we are thinking about how do you create safe communities across the board? How do you ensure that communities are not over-policed or under-policed. And there are communities where both of those things happen. I don't need to be telling all of you, I'm sure you all are aware of that, that there is, for example, there is a stark disparity in the clearance of homicides. Sometimes even very particularly racially based on the victims, the race of the victims or the perpetrators or the communities. And how do we create systems and environments where people trust police to cooperate with, where people are finding that safety is something that is not just for whiter or more economically advantaged communities, where everybody can be safe, where schools are safe. So I think we're trying to figure out ways to create that safety and figuring out what actually works and doesn't without, I mean, I'm just not going to be able to speak authoritatively on what causes crime to go up or down. I think what we know, what we can talk about is what in particular communities helps people both feel safe and shows that, you know, violent crime is going down and different things like that. But I really appreciate all of the work that you're doing. And I'm really impressed about the spectrum of issues that you're engaged in. It's wonderful to hear that.
Thanks. Jeremy, you have a question?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this before we started, Ruby. I really appreciate your remarks. And I'm very interested because you've been in the room with law enforcement leaders who have said this. I remember hearing this in the summer of 2020 in a quite public way. You know, we don't want to be the people on these calls. We don't want to be doing these things. But I suspect, and I'm interested in your perspective because you've been in the room for these conversations, that very quickly gets us to the question of resources. And I know that the defund word makes people very nervous and some people get a little bit worked up quickly, but fundamentally, unless we're talking about a bigger pie and increasing taxes, these are resources that would be taken from police departments, sheriff departments, and directed towards some kind of social services, some kind of mental health services. Obviously, we know in cases like Elijah McClain of the lack of ability of law enforcement to deal with many issues, especially at the intersection of law enforcement and disability. But when we say this, when you open these conversations, because you've been in the room, it sounds good for law enforcement to say, we don't want to do these things. We'd love to have other people on these calls. But when it comes to the bottom line, and it comes to a question of funding, do those conversations continue? Can they continue to happen in the room with a law enforcement leader if the question it leads then to, okay, how do we redirect some of this funding? And we don't have to use the scary word of defund, but how do we redirect some of these funds towards building out and building up the kind of services that will lead to better outcomes when, for example, there's a mental health crisis or, you know, the kind of calls that police officers and law enforcement leaders say they don't want to be on?
Yeah, I think that's a challenging question, candidly. And I think different law enforcement people leaders will come out differently. Some of it was going to depend a little bit on what they see available in their communities already. Like I said, I think sometimes they are the reluctant only source, and often they can be very helpful. And some of the leaders in our group have been very helpful in thinking about and leading their communities to other like alternatives. But I think those are hard conversations and very community dependent. I can think of, for example, you know, we have a sheriff in Middlesex County, Massachusetts, who created and really brought the stakeholders in his community together to create a restoration center, which is a one-stop shop for treatment and services and referrals for individuals with substance and behavioral health issues. And it's a way to divert them from arrest. The data showed that 70% of the people in the Middlesex jail had open mental health cases, and 80% had a history of substance issues. So, I mean, it was a long, drawn out process within the community and within the system, you know, to try and figure out how do you create the resources for this restoration center. But the sheriff was the leader in trying to do that, Sheriff Peter Katushin, who's on our executive board. I think another example I can, another sheriff in Washtenaw County, which is in Ann Arbor, Michigan, he created a co-responder program and implemented it. And the reason was that he had found that his office was the primary responder for 80% or more of the calls that they responded to were, again, related to some kind of mental health issue. So he partnered with his community health group to work on creating a co-responder program. So if the sheriff deputy is accompanied by somebody from the community mental health department. And this is a way to provide short-term mental health stabilization and resources immediately. And it also resulted in fewer arrests, and the deputies were happy at being not the primary responder for these mental health calls. So I think things like that, where, you know, you're getting law enforcement chiefs and leaders to actually be the voices in their communities for advocating for these type of programs, it's a start. I agree with you that it's going to always be challenging, because the other thing that we're facing is a policing and prosecutors, you know, their offices are facing retention and recruitment issues. So there's a challenge in terms of staffing across the board. So there are a lot of challenges, and I think like the fiscal issue is going to be an issue within different communities that they're going to be responding to differently. I think law enforcement leaders, though, are really trying to engage in how can we work with our communities to respond, to create these responses better. I will tell you that one of the challenges that people have said in the law enforcement community, at least, about this is sometimes, you know, you want a non-police mental health response to like mental health or some of those issues. But sometimes you're not going to find any other responder who is going to be available 24/7 and willing to do it. And how do you get that training, and how do you create those responders? It's a lot more challenging than just diverting it, right? Like sometimes a call, and sometimes you're going to hear from social workers or mental health employees that, you know, they don't want to be the sole responder for some of these calls, because, you know, there is also sometimes a concern, security concern on their part. So I think there are different programs and different ways to try and think about how do we create those, but it's a long process of both funding and also culture and staffing and training that I think all of these different components in our communities are going to need to work together to try and figure out how to get to.
Great. Robbie? you're still on mute, Robbie.
Sorry about that. Thank you, Ruby, for this wonderful presentation. You know, the First Step Act had broad bipartisan support. It was signed into law by President Trump, former President Trump. Does the First Step Implementation Act, does it enjoy support right now? And do you foresee it passing, or did it pass already?
It did not pass already. I think we're at a point in our federal legislative context environment where there is nothing that is really passing. I think that that's unfortunately where we are. I don't think any of those right now in this current, let's say in this current Congress, right? We're in an election year. I think it's unlikely that anything will pass, except possibly, and I am no like predictor of what's going to happen on the Hill, but I don't think anybody should try to be. But I think it's possible that the Federal Prison Oversight Act, which did have bipartisan support in both the Senate and the House, that could pass. And there's a bill that's pending called the Victim Act, and I don't remember what victim stands for, but it would fund, and this is actually an interesting question about policing and clearances, it would fund investigators in police departments. And the idea is to help police departments build up their detective and investigative capacity to try and actually focus on clearing violent crimes like homicides, this whole clearance issue that we've been talking about. Those are two bills that potentially could pass, but nobody I think that I know of is predicting. I mean, like we're sort of at a point where if something passes, we'll be really ecstatic because I think at this point, federally, nothing is really happening. The hope is really, our goal is really to try and continue to build support for the idea that these reforms are important as a longer term goal. So hopefully maybe by next year.
Thank you. Just one quick comment. I understand, speaking about what causes crime, I understand that in the 90s, prior to implementation of the three strikes law, that crime rates were trending downward nationwide.
That's interesting. I'm not a huge expert on crime rates back in the 90s, so I can't really speak to that, but that is really interesting. I mean, it's an interesting question about what that means about what we did in our, you know, kind of how our ratcheting up of criminal sentences might have impacted crime rates.
Because I know that Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book, The Outliers, and he devotes a whole chapter to that.
Oh, interesting.
That topic, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And, you know, one interesting part of that debate as well is when we talk about the upticks in crime in 20 and 2021, often it isn't in the context of violent crime rates being some of the lowest in history. In 2013, 2014, around that period. So while we're seeing an uptick, it's not nearly what the crime rates were in recent history, including in the 90s, particularly violent crime rates. One of the areas where I think the opponents of reform, let's say, have created challenges for reform include among reform-minded prosecutors, sometimes called progressive prosecutors. We've had at least two elected here in California, Chesa Boudin up in San Francisco, who was almost immediately recalled after he was able to surprisingly win election. And now George Gascon, the district attorney in Los Angeles, is facing a recall effort. These are normally very well-funded. Can you talk about some of the challenges that have been made to these reform-minded prosecutors and what role you think prosecutors can have in actually creating the types of reforms that we're seeking?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's definitely a new, I think, relatively new development in reform and also the pushback on reform. I think I'll take the second part of your question first. The power that prosecutors can have is, I think, quite substantial, at least within the area of, you know, after an individual is arrested. There's this concept that I'm sure all of you are aware of called prosecutorial discretion. They have wide, far-reaching discretionary powers that basically decide what charges to bring, whether to seek bail, what sentences to recommend, what plea offers to make. The vast majority of the cases in our criminal justice system are resolved by plea. And so they really can wield a lot of power. It also, according to the ABA, prosecutorial power includes the responsibility of exercising discretion to not pursue criminal charges in appropriate circumstances. And so what has happened, and you know, George Gascon and Chesa Boudin and a few others across the country are examples of prosecutors, you know, this prosecutorial discretion, historically unreviewed, has been traditionally used to, you know, I think critics of prosecutorial discretion have said it's historically been used to ratchet up sentences, has fostered racial disparities and excessive incarceration, because prosecutors were usually using it to be more punitive. And in recent years, starting, you know, I think people put it to like 2014, 2016, elected DAs around the country started running on the idea of, we are going to use our prosecutorial discretion to not pursue certain cases, to emphasize diversion and non-prosecution, advocate for shorter sentences, reduce racial disparities, increase transparency. Kim Fox, elected in 2016 in Cook County, Chicago, was one of the first. Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, Chase Boudin, George Gascon, and others. And so I think partly because of the success of this movement, it's come under attack. The resistance has been directed towards the idea that they can, decide to prosecute. Many of them have announced that they're not going to prosecute certain classes of offenses, such as simple drug possession, loitering, sex work, et cetera. And critics have said, you can use your discretion, but it's really only in individual cases. You shouldn't be using it across the board to say, I'm not going to prosecute a class of cases. But others have pointed out that prosecutors' offices have always had informal, internal understandings, whether it's within the office or maybe with the defense bar, about, hey, we're not going to prosecute above a certain threshold of possession, or, you know, whatever it is, that there are informal guidelines. So what these DAs are doing, and it's interesting because they're elected, right? So in a democracy, does the public have a right to know what their DA's office is doing in terms of just deciding, hey, I'm going to tell you I'm not going to prosecute this class of cases? So I think that, you know, the pushback has been very real. It's not just these recall efforts. I think recall efforts are one example. They're an electoral approach where at least you are taking an existing electoral process and using it, whether it's, you know, whether those are being manipulated or not. But there's also efforts to do punitive measures in, I think, a little bit more unprecedented ways. There was an effort to impeach Philadelphia's district attorney, Larry Krasner, which was actually put on hold by the trial court, because the trial court, in a very close decision, they basically said, you know, you're basically impeaching him for exercising his discretion, and that's not a legitimate basis for impeachment. It's now, I think, before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, so it's an open question. But again, that was like quite unprecedented for the Pennsylvania House, state house, to reach in and try and impeach a local elected district attorney. And I think many of you are probably aware of the also unprecedented moves by the Florida governor to suspend local elected district attorneys. So Tampa's locally elected district attorney, Andrew Warren, who announced that he opposed using prosecutorial resources to criminalize abortion services, reproductive health services, and gender affirming health care. So DeSantis removed him, which was actually found by the federal district court to be in violation of Andrew Warren's First Amendment rights. But then it was pending before the Florida State Supreme Court, which said it was out of time. It's kind of complicated judicial procedure, but basically, you know, DeSantis removed him. And then almost exactly a year later, the governor removed Orlando's elected state attorney, Monique Worrell. Again, unprecedented removal of a state, and she's got a case pending that challenges that removal. And then people have also, I think there's been a category of pushback based on putting specific limits on the exercise of discretion. Like, for example, a state enacting a law that prohibits prosecuting attorneys from filing misdemeanor offenses if a felony charge is available. That is fairly unprecedented for a state law to actually try and dictate the choices that prosecutors make. But that happened, that was passed in Utah. Another example is in Georgia, which enacted a prosecutorial commission that would basically a disciplinary body that would, a state disciplinary body comprised of political appointees that could investigate prosecutors who allegedly engage in misconduct, which was fairly broadly defined. And critically, any person could file a complaint opening an investigation. So there could be a victim, it could be just really anybody, whether it's a charging decision, plea offer, placement of a case on a trial calendar, any decision by a prosecutor. And that's on hold before the Georgia Supreme Court. And then there's also moves to transfer the grant of power over certain classes of cases to another body, whether it's like the attorney general or another official. And that's, you know, happened in, I think, Pennsylvania and Texas and other places. So there's a lot of different efforts to impact the role of local elected district attorneys. And, you know, the very interesting thing about these district attorneys is, you know, a few examples aside, like the Chase Subudin recall, a lot of these leaders have been elected and now reelected in their communities. So although you have states and others who are saying their policies are unpopular, they, like Larry Krasner, Kim Fox, others have been reelected because I think their communities may be a little bit more responsive to their what they're saying they're doing and why they're doing it than the public conversation about prosecutorial reform. But it is a growing movement of both prosecutorial reform and the resistance to it. So it will be very interesting to see how it develops. And we'll be keeping a close eye on what's happening in Los Angeles, I think tomorrow, right?
And Matt, I see you have one more question.
Yeah, this is actually from our Q&A, so from the audience. The question is localized, Ruby, so I will ask it in the national context. Do you know the statistics for minority defendants compared to white defendants in the court system?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I can imagine that there are a lot more minority defendants than white defendants based on my knowledge of specifically things like drug cases and my experience at the federal level on drug cases and things like that. I don't know off the top of my head though, and I couldn't speak nationally. But it's probably something that I could easily find out if that's something that would be of interest for me to get back to you on.
Thank you for that, Matt. We've run out of time. I could spend another hour talking with you, so perhaps we'll have you back, Ruby. I really appreciate it. But I know one thing you wanted to mention was your work with the Women's Prison Association, which somewhat goes to Amber's earlier question.
Oh, yes. Thank you for reminding me. I did want to mention it when Amber was talking about all the different things that she works on. So I'm on the board of an organization, a nonprofit in New York City, where I live, called the Women's Prison Association, which was the nation's first organization that responds to justice-involved women and the needs of justice-involved women. And we do a variety of services, the organization, which I serve on the board of, so I'm not engaged in the day-to-day work, but I really value the work that I do on the board because it really does a lot of work, reentry services, in-prison services, family reunification, transitional housing across the board, trying to help women, but divert them. And, you know, so they're not, they don't become justice involved. And then also as they are leaving prison and jails, figuring out how to help them on their reentry, work with them to try and figure out job training and services and other things like that. And I think it's really notable. And I think one of the things that, Amber was talking about, alluded to, the increase in women in the prison system is something that we have seen over the past, I think, decade. That is something that is a really notable development about how the population of women has increased, and our prisons and our jails and our reentry services are not responding to and accounting for the specific needs of women across the board. And so it's something that is really important to try and think about. And I hope that many of you will continue to have that conversation as well.
Great. Thank you so much, Ruby, for all your work in all the different forms that it's taken over the years. I really appreciate you being with us. I want to thank Thin Lee, the information technology consultant here at CSUSB, for supporting us in all matters tech related, and Pamela Crosshun in the History Department for all her work behind the scenes and administrative support. Support for the event also comes from the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee and the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences. So thank everybody for participating, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for having me.